This is VOA News via remote. I'm Michael Brown. The U.S. House of Representatives Tuesday night approved a resolution urging Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment to the Constitution to remove President Donald Trump with a cabinet vote from office and declare what is obvious to a horrified nation that the president is unable to successfully discharge the duties and powers of his office. The Democrats proceeded even though Pence said he would not do what the resolution asked. Pence made his intentions known late Tuesday night in a letter to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, citing the mechanism should not be used as a means of punishment or usurpation and reserved for cases of medical or mental incapacitation. Meantime, a small group of growing number of Republican lawmakers is signaling support for impeaching President Trump after his supporters stormed the Capitol last week to try to upend his reelection defeat, leaving five people dead. Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, a member of the Republican Party's House leadership team, said Tuesday that she would vote to impeach Trump, adding that there has never been a greater betrayal by a president of the United States of his office and his oath to the Constitution. While an impeachment resolution would be almost certain to pass, conviction by the Senate and removal from office is far from certain. The New York Times reports U.S. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell has told associates he believes President Trump has committed impeachable offenses after the attack on the Capitol. The major newspaper also reported the majority leader is pleased that Democrats are moving to impeach him, citing people familiar with his thinking. For more news, join us at voanews.com via remote. This is VOA News. U.S. officials say some of the 10,000 National Guard troops deployed to Washington, D.C. to help secure the area ahead of the President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration will be armed. The decision by the U.S. Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy comes as the FBI has warned of armed protests being planned for Washington in the run-up to the January 20th inauguration. One of the officials said the troops would not be the first line of defense and would be supporting law enforcement agencies, but given the threat around the Capitol, troops needed to be equipped with their weapons for self-defense. The increased security also comes after hundreds of supporters of President Trump ransacked the Capitol building as Congress was in session to certify Biden's win, battling with police, sending lawmakers fleeing for safety. Washington's mayor urging the public to not come to the city for the inauguration ceremony in light of the security concerns. The military's top leaders have issued a written reminder to all U.S. service members that the deadly insurrection at the Capitol last week was an anti-democratic criminal act and that the right to free speech gives no one the right to commit violence. The memo signed by all members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is unusual in that the military leadership felt compelled to remind service members that it was wrong to disrupt the constitutional process. The memo was issued Tuesday amid worry about renewed violence on Inauguration Day next Wednesday. The United States is releasing millions of COVID-19 vaccine doses it was holding back for use as second shots in the inoculate Americans older than 65, as well as Americans with underlying health conditions. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said Tuesday the new strategy would not interfere with Americans waiting for a first dose. In the United States, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said more than 9 million Americans had been given their first COVID-19 vaccination doses as of Monday morning. That is less than a third of the total doses distributed to states by the U.S. government. States, not the federal government, are responsible for administering the vaccines to their citizens. Meantime, while COVID-19 cases continue to spike across the U.S., many state leaders are showing reluctance to order further lockdowns. For details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, reporting remote, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, January 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ugandan President Museveni defends the blocking of all social media platforms ahead of Thursday's election.
That social channel you are talking about, if it is going to operate in Uganda, it should be used equitably by everybody who has to use it. If you want to take sides against the NRM, then that group would not operate in Uganda.
Ugandan opposition leader Bobi Wine says the military raided his home on Tuesday and beat one of his bodyguards. Zambia's main opposition leader says more people should be fired for corruption at the health ministry. The WFP warns of pending starvation in southern Madagascar, and COVID-19 killed two Malawian cabinet members as the president declares a state of national disaster.
This declaration of a state of national disaster is but a first step towards a possible declaration of a state of emergency, subject to consultation with and approval from the Defense and Security Committee of the National Assembly.
And Zimbabwe bans the movement of dead bodies amid COVID-19 pandemic. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ahead of tomorrow, Thursday's general elections, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni says he ordered the shutdown of social media sites in the country. He lashed out at social media companies for interfering in what he called Ugandan politics and said Ugandans cannot tolerate such arrogance. Meanwhile, opposition leaders in Uganda say they have agreed to work together to protect Thursday's vote from being rigged. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakariji has more from Kampala.
Clad in a military jacket, President Museveni addressed the nation Tuesday night ahead of the hotly contested elections and urged Ugandan voters to turn out en masse and vote for the ruling, the National Resistance Movement Party. Mr. Museveni, who has been in power for over 35 years, alleged that the opposition is planning to rig elections and also plotting to commit violence during and after the elections.
Nobody would intimidate you. Nobody will attack you. If anybody tries to do that, we shall get him or her. So therefore, don't fear anything. Go out and vote. You saw how the rioters were defeated in Kampala here. There's no threat we cannot defeat. Don't miss the chance to vote. You go out and vote. We shall defend you. We have got all sorts of means.
As on several previous occasions, President Museveni accused foreign powers for wanting to influence Ugandan politics. He particularly pointed out social media giant Facebook for favoring the opposition.
There's no way anybody can come and play around with our country to decide who is good, who is bad. This one we stop, this one we cannot accept that. Therefore, I'm very sorry about the inconvenience to those who have been using this channel. Even myself, when I had time, I was interacting with the young people through it, but we cannot tolerate this arrogance of anybody coming to decide for us who is good and who is bad. That's what we cannot accept.
This week, social media giant Facebook closed several accounts belonging to ruling party officials and the government, saying those accounts were manipulating debate ahead of the elections. Earlier Tuesday, leading opposition candidates held a news conference and promised to defend Thursday's vote from being rigged. Patrick Oboi Amuriat is the president of the opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC.
Ugandans have been calling on some kind of unity. Today, you know, you can see that we are united in this struggle. I know that many have always thought that we should, you know, have a joint candidate, but there are different ways to unite, and this is the first step in ensuring that we unite in calling on Ugandans to come and vote and also protect their votes.
Opposition leader Robert Chagrani, also known as Bobi Wine, called on the Electoral Commission and security organs not to be partisan.
I want to send a message to the Electoral Commission. You have studied our history. You know what a bad election has done to this country. So we call upon you to reflect on what you are doing. We call upon you to remember that The lives of 45 million people are in your hands, are on your shoulders. So it is important that you respect the voices of the people of Uganda.
The singer turned politician is the main challenger to incumbent President Yoweri Museveni. Over 18 million Ugandan voters are registered to vote in the January 14th polls for both parliament and the president. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinjini, Kampala, Uganda.
Ugandan opposition leader Bobi Wine says the military raided his home on Tuesday and beat one of his bodyguards 2 days before the presidential election. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Singer-turned-politician Robert Kyagulanyi, better known as Bobi Wine, has not campaigned for the last 5 days. With authorities restricting his movements, Wine has spent most of his time at his house on the outskirts of Kampala. Speaking to reporters Tuesday, he accused police of invading his home.
This morning, my house was raided. Two of my gardeners were taken away, and my security guard was beaten very badly. Even the polling agents that we sent out there, even the coordinators that have been identifying and recruiting polling agents are being rounded up and arrested and charged with recruiting rebels.
Wine is campaigning for president as candidate of the National Unity Platform Party, which has become the main opposition group in Uganda. Tuesday was meant to be the final day of campaigning for all presidential candidates in the central areas of Kampala, Mukono, and Wakiso districts. However, in December, the Electoral Commission suspended campaigns in 12 districts considered opposition strongholds. The commission said it was following guidelines by the Ministry of Health to curb the spread of COVID-19. Meanwhile, over 100 National Unity Platform supporters are being held in different detention centers around the country. The police say many of those arrested belong to youth brigades that have been involved in criminal activities ahead and during the elections. Opposition and human rights activists accuse the government of paving the way for another election victory by President Yoweri Museveni, who is seeking to extend his 34-year rule over Uganda. Police spokesperson Fred Enanga says police have credible intelligence that Wine intends to go into hiding after casting his vote Thursday.
Honorable Kyagulanyi Ssentamu Robert wants to go into hiding, possibly in one of the embassies, immediately after casting his vote, and thereafter alleged through his Noop networks and bloggers that he has been kidnapped by state operatives. This intention is to incite the public.
As Ugandans wait to cast their vote Thursday, few have access to sites such as Facebook, WhatsApp, and Twitter after the government ordered a shutdown of social media. In a letter, the Uganda Communications Commission directed all telecom companies to immediately suspend any access and use of all social media platforms and online messaging applications over the networks until further notice. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Two ministers in the cabinet of Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera died on Tuesday from COVID-19 amid steep rise in COVID cases. In a televised address, President Chakwera urged Malawians to take protective measures. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Speaking on state media from his residence in the capital, Lilongwe, President Chakwera ordered that national flags fly at half staff and called for 3 days of national mourning. Linkson Bereganyama was the Minister of Local Government and Muhammad Sidigmiya was the Minister of Transport. Their deaths come as Malawi deals with an unprecedented rise in cases and deaths from COVID-19. Chakwera said he was saddened that out of 235 COVID-19 deaths registered since the second wave began in November, 50% of them have come since January 1. The rise in cases, he said, has compelled him to issue a number of directives.
In accordance with Section 32, Subsection 1, of the Disaster Preparedness and Relief Act of 1991, I declare a state of national disaster in respect of all the districts of the country with effect from today, January 12, 2021.
Chakwera appealed for more assistance to fight COVID-19 from the international community, relevant United Nations agencies, non-governmental organizations, and the private sector. He warned more stringent measures against the pandemic are yet to come.
This declaration of a state of national disaster is but a first step towards a possible declaration of a state of emergency, subject to consultation with and approval from the Defense and Security Committee of the National Assembly, as stipulated in Section 45 of the Constitution.
Local media reports say nearly half of Jagwira's 32-member cabinet is infected with COVID-19. Government officials disputed this. However, two cabinet ministers have declared themselves COVID-19 positive. Labor Minister Kenny Kandodo and Minister of Industry Roy Kachale. President Jagwira concluded his address by urging Malawians not to lose hope. He encouraged them to police one another in observing COVID-19 preventive measures, which include washing hands with soap, observing social distance recommendations, and putting on face coverings. Lameke Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, January 13th. Zambia's main opposition leader, Hakainde Hichilema, says President Edgar Lungu's decision to fire Health Minister Dr. Chitalu Chilufya is a little too late. The president dismissed Chilufya after auditors and a parliamentary committee uncovered corruption involving the supply of $70 million worth of substandard medicine. A company named Honeybee Pharmaceuticals is accused of supplying leaky latex condoms, defective surgical gloves, and fake medicine, which were allegedly distributed by Minister Chilufya. Charles Kakoma, the spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, says the party is calling on President Lungu to fire others who, like Dr. Chilufya, are also responsible for the death of innocent Zambians.
As the largest opposition political party in Zambia, we have been calling for the dismissal of the health minister, Dr. Chitalu Chilufya, for a very long time. But the president was dragging his feet. Now that he has decided to fire him finally, we think that the firing is not sufficient, it's not enough, because he subjected the Zambian people to the purchase of expired drugs worth $17 million. And a lot of people consumed those expired drugs, their health is now affected. And the tender was given in suspicious circumstances to people that have connection to the health minister. So we believe that apart from firing him, he must be arrested and taken to court and be prosecuted. That is the only way we can send a signal to other ministers that corruption does not pay.
Do you think this issue with Honeybee and the supply of leaking condoms, gloves, and fake medicine, does it have any impact on the COVID-19 situation right now?
Well, there are other issues also connected to the same minister. In fact, in the Auditor General's report, it was reported that the donations that were given by many stakeholders, including international organizations, the funds for COVID-19 were squandered, stolen. And at that time, again, we called for the dismissal of the Minister of Finance, the Minister of Health, but the President did not heed our calls. So up to now, that money for COVID has been squandered, it has been stolen. Meanwhile, the cases of COVID are rising. And there are no medicines in hospitals. People are even struggling to get a face mask. You know, people donated a lot of face masks to the Ministry of Health, which have not been distributed. We do not know where they've taken those face masks.
In addition to the dismissal of Dr. Chilufya, your leader is also calling for the dismissal of other people. For example, Stephen Kampiongo and Kanganja. What is their connection with this?
Well, it is the same corrupt group of people. In fact, apart from the Minister of Health and the purchase of those drugs, the same cartel was involved in the killing of two innocent people just a week ago. They organized the police to start shooting at unarmed civilians who were escorting Kainde Hichilema to the force headquarters where he was summoned. So up to now, we have got no full report on what really transpired. But what we saw is the president dismissing some junior police officers, while those at the top, including Police Inspector General Kakoma Ganganja, are still in their offices. But they are the commanders that ordered the killing of innocent people. They should also go. But the president is still protecting them.
Thank you so much, Mr. Kakoma. It's so nice to talk with you, sir.
Thank you very much, James.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. The UN World Food Programme says 5 years of recurrent drought and the COVID-19 pandemic have brought southern Madagascar to its knees, with hundreds of thousands of its inhabitants struggling to find enough food to eat. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Lack of rain and poor harvests have left more than one-third of southern Madagascar's population short of food, not knowing from where their next meal will come. The World Food Program says 1.3 million people are going hungry, nearly double what it was in the same period last year. Lola Castro is WFP Regional Director for Southern Africa and Indian Ocean States. Speaking on a video link from Johannesburg, she says the drought and lockdown triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic have caused seasonal employment to dry up. Every year, between April and November, she says people in the region seek work in the cities and fields in rural areas. She says the population depends on the earnings from this casual labor. However, this year, she says there were no jobs because of the drought and COVID-19 lockdown.
The rains that normally come November, December, we only had one day of rain in December in the whole region. And the sandstorms have been blasting the region, have been blasting and destroying and burying the crops that they were there. So basically, what is the result? The result is a famine-like condition.
The result, she says, is a looming humanitarian crisis. She says 1.3 million people in Madagascar are short of food and facing starvation. She says more than 135,000 children under five are suffering from severe or acute malnutrition.
What are we seeing? The children have abandoned schools. 75% of the children in this area are either begging or foraging for food. The people are eating whatever they can find, between cactus mixed with mud, roots, whatever they can find, leaves, seeds, whatever is available.
The World Food Program is providing food aid to nearly 500,000 people in the 9 hardest hit districts in southern Madagascar. The WFP says it would like to scale up its assistance program to reach almost 900,000 of the most vulnerable by June. However, that depends on funding. Currently, the agency says it is running a deficit and urgently needs $35 million to provide life-saving food, badly needed cash, and malnutrition treatment programs to the many in desperate need. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Zimbabwe Ministry of Health has prohibited the movement of dead bodies, and that bodies can only be taken from a mortuary to the burial site in a bid to fight the spread of COVID-19. Reporter Kuzai Navashe has more from Harare.
Burials in Zimbabwe are an opportunity for loved ones to bid farewell to the departed. Most people choose to bury loved ones at their place of origin, but now there are limits on that practice. New restrictions have also cut the crowds at burials to a handful of people. Donald Mujiri is the Minister of Health spokesperson.
They converge, but only 30 maximum, but 4 meters distance apart.
Unlike in the past, the corpse will not be taken to where mourners are gathered, such as a family home, and viewings of the deceased are not allowed. A police statement advised that bodies will not be moved between provinces, and they will only move from the mortuary to the burial site. Dr. Norman Matara is with the Zimbabwe Doctors for Human Rights.
We do not think that is a scientifically led or scientifically informed decision by the government, because with COVID-19, we know that the dead body does not infect people with COVID-19. The Center for Disease Control actually has guidelines, even the WHO, on how to handle a dead body. And what was put by the ministry is not even in those guidelines.
Dr. Agnes Mahomba is the head of the National COVID-19 Task Force, and she says the rules are not because the body poses a risk of infection.
Part of it is not so much of the body itself. It's the process of the people who then carry it, who do all sorts of things, gatherings and so on. That is actually the thing that is being stopped.
Many other countries around the world, including Italy, Mexico and some places in the United States, have imposed similar restrictions on funerals and memorial gatherings. In some communities, funeral services are held online, with burials done later, with only a few in attendance. Mahomba says there are special cases where the corpse is coming from outside the country, and those cases can be exempted if they seek authorization from the ministry officials. Matara says the culture of the people has been violated without providing any benefit for the COVID-19 fight. Mahomba said people should be patient as the lockdown will not last forever, and the nation now is almost 2 weeks into the month-long lockdown. For VOA, this is Kudzesh Namashe from Harare.
The United Nations Environment Programme is calling for a green pandemic recovery to help bring emissions levels by 2030 to meet the 2 degrees Celsius goal. The planet and energy campaigner for Greenpeace in Africa, Thandile Chiamvayu, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the lack of political will currently plaguing the issue and what needs to be done to ensure a green recovery in Southern Africa.
Right now, what we're struggling with mostly is the energy deficit. So a green recovery for Southern Africa would be investing more heavily in renewable energy. There has been an increased uptake in renewable energy in the sub-Saharan Africa. However, there is still much political will for fossil fuel development and specifically in gas, oil, as well as some pursuits in nuclear. A green recovery, we need to focus more on the immediate benefits that renewable energy could pose to us, and that's immediate job creation and really filling out the deficit of the energy that we're missing. And just assessing energy poverty could really provide South Africans and those in Southern Africa with an opportunity to have more development and growth really required during this recovery period.
What are some of the challenges or impediments to this action being taken?
Definitely there's a lack of political will. Just in the past year, in terms of politics and what we've seen with some of the politics in South Africa, our Minister of Health recently doubled emission standards for the minimum emission standards for sulfur dioxide, which really allows for the fossil fuel companies, one of our carbon majors, Sasol, to thrive. Our Minister of Energy continues to pursue offshore oil prospects. So right now the barriers to that are the politicians serving the carbon majors' interests.
Are there any countries specifically in Southern Africa that could be held up as role models or that you think are taking the proper steps needed?
It's a challenging one because we share a lot of the same barriers and challenges to actually uptaking more renewable energy and moving towards green recovery. I think in terms of Africa as a whole, I would point towards Kenya as being really the bastion of, as you know, historically we were using more renewable energy. And although there's been a lot of pressure internationally for them to adopt more fossil fuel, specifically coal, firepower stations being proposed to be built there, they still remain the bastion of climate action, as they are the climate action tracker. They are the most aligned to the 2 degrees Celsius world target.
Africa as a whole produces a lot less emissions than other countries around the world. Is there a conversation being had that talks about how those countries can contribute to this effort, I guess, to reduce emissions in African countries?
The reality is that South Africa, specifically on our continent, is one of the largest emitters. Greenpeace Africa recently released a report that actually revealed that Greater Mpumalanga is one of the biggest SO2 emission hotspots in the continent, and it's actually the largest coal combustion-driven emissions hotspot in the world. And that is an absolutely shocking statistic to realize that we rank so high in terms of emissions in the world.
That was Thandile Chiamvayu, the planet and energy campaigner for Greenpeace in Africa. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Cape Town, South Africa. And that's it for this Wednesday, January 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you a very good day.